All right, the clock is on. We're on. Well, thank you for coming tonight. This is the number third lesson of our fall series and of the study of the land, which is an extension of last year's study. We'll finally finish it probably this year sometime, next year sometime. I don't know. I don't care. I don't have it laid out, but I don't have my lessons laid out. So when I find an interesting current, I follow it. You know, kind of like when you're mining for gold, you don't abandon a good current just because, oh, might be something better over there. So we're making up it as we go along. Today we're going to have historic information, and one fear I have is there people know something more, many people know more about history than I do. So I'm always afraid I'm going to step in it and make a fool of myself. So if you do want to make a fool of me, do it after class. It may not be hard. In some way, I want to apologize for doing history. And then I'm thinking, why? And I say, well, the reason we do history is because it's God's glory. I've heard it to me. I don't interested in history. You know, it's just so boring. You know, so I just, you know, I don't know what the rest of the word is, but it's just so boring to me. And maybe you sit here this evening being drugged by your spouse or something. You're here because you don't like history. I want to be here to help you learn to like it because it is so, so rich and fulfilling when you can see in the past what God has done in minute little details, things that at that time was not noticed by anybody and end up being major, major events. So I just want to encourage you and not have me apologize for history. Now, our interest in history is always interested around Israel, because when God does something in the world, likely it's going to have something to do with Israel. And if Israel's involved, probably can know that God's involved in it. So we have the Bible talks quite a bit about what God's going to do for Israel. So in other words, we have a biblical foundation for our history, and we're not upset by Putin invading or whatever he's doing in Syria today. It's just part of the plan. In fact, I'm kind of wondering what he's doing there. Where does it fit? You know, we have all kinds of ideas, and as I get a little older, and I've not written a book on this, so I can change my views. You got that? If you'd want to write a book, you're stuck. So I'm not going to write a book because I do want to be able to flex with the views. I think sometimes we get a little bit ahead of ourselves and what is happening and how that fits this and how it fits this, and I'm all for that if it's true, but got to be a little careful we don't get ahead of ourselves and look a little foolish later on. So anyway, all that to say is we're going to look at history tonight, and I hope you find it interesting. I told my wife this maybe seems strange to you, and maybe I'm not successful at it, but the first thing I have to do to you, no matter what I do for you, is make it interesting. Right? Tell me that. Come on, tell me it's true. If it's not interesting, no matter what I say, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's sort of like, now, I shouldn't have said that because now you're going to wonder whether it's going to be interesting. Well, it's interesting to me. I found that if it's interesting to me, then it can be interesting to somebody else. So I said my major was not history. In high school, my major was getting out of it. And when I went to college, I didn't understand much about history. I took the required perfunctory courses, and I really couldn't tell you anything I learned. And so I started studying things after I was an adult, much of an adult. About in 1990, I said, I'm going to quit reading newspapers. Sorry, Larry. I told him this. I apologize to him. Sorry. And when I was reading the USA Today, so it's okay. And I'm going to use that time to start reading books, and it changed my life. I mean, it changed the rest of my life because I kept on reading, and it becomes habit forming. And then my interest in the Bible certainly is first, but I have been here since Gil came. So I have a good foundation of Scripture, and I don't have the language skills like you do. So there's no use being an expositor, I thought. We have one of those, a good one, outstanding one. So I'm going to follow what I'm interested in, and that's putting together not only the Bible, but also how it interfaces with our daily living, and then it took me to history. So I'm not only teaching history, but it just happened to be tonight we're going to talk a lot about history. In fact, our whole series is going to be about history because it's contemporary history. History that a lot of us have seen and lived and watched and had views about. And it does seem like history as we know it is coming to a close here in these next few years as the Lord would seem to be preparing to return. And I believe the earth will be here when it's all over, but history as we know it and the way we know it. I've got a map up there of Europe. I'm sure you recognize that. So we'll talk about that when we get to it. I got a couple of subjects tonight. Remind you that we start our study, or started our study, with the promise God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob about the land. And the land was for his family. While the historical record shows that they have occupied the land, they have only occupied it just a little bit more than one-third of the time. Think about that. They've been out of it most of the time. Maybe closer to half, depending on how you count. And in the present exile, or they call it diaspora, they've been out of the land for 1,900 years. Now, again, there have been Jews in the land, but as a nation, they ceased to exist. As an independent nation, they haven't existed since 586 B.C. So they've been under somebody's thumb since then, called the time of the Gentiles. Now, in the 19th century, which is 1800s, we observed a rustling of change in the bullpen. You understand that figure? As the Lord takes observable measures to make good his promises regarding the land for the Jews. Remember, the land is land leased to the Jews. They've never actually given it to them because God says the land is his, and therefore Israel never own it, but they will own it in a land lease arrangement. Now, what were these observable events? Well, first of all, people, the people aspect of it. These people begin to provide an appetite for a return to the land. They're writers. They're, in one case, a political figure in England, Disraeli, is a prime minister. And so people are starting to talk about it. Not that they didn't say every year the Jerusalem in their prayer. Every year they said next year in Jerusalem. That's been the wish of the Jews since the diaspora. But this was different. This was different. The people begin to have an appetite for a return to the land. Again, a small, small portion of the people. Now, there are events and the personages that are raised up to hammer out this raising of their hopes. In warfare, I think that compare this in warfare, general bombing cannot conquer a people, but it can weaken them. For an on-ground invasion of the enemy. And that's really what this was. It's sort of like preparing the groundwork, what was coming. Then as the groundwork is prepared, these ideas begin to catch on fire, and then they get caught in the minds of other Jews and so forth. One of these early ones was Moses Hess because of the Damascus libel, the blood libel, who was accused of killing Jews, and that stirred sympathies for the Jewish people that they'd be so mistreated. And I mentioned Disraeli. We also have a guy named Pinsker who organized an organization called Lovers of Zion or Lovers of Israel. And then we have Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of Zionism in 1897. And he becomes really the pivotal person in this development of Zionism. Zionism is simply developing a homeland for the Jews. Zion is another word for Israel, or for Jerusalem. Then we had the pogroms, which means just disturbances, I don't know what other word, there's a Russian word, I forgot exactly what the translation is, but in Western Russia, last week we talked about that, they started in 1881, and they went on and off clear up until the World War I, and there was persecution under the Tsars, of the Jews under the Tsar, Alexander III, Tsar Alexander II was killed in St. Petersburg. You see the church on your right, and it's the Church of the Savior on Spilt Blood. The Church on the Savior of Spilt Blood. The Spilt Blood is the site where the Tsar was killed, and he was a good Tsar. Alexander II was a good Tsar. He did a lot of reforms and so forth. And it's interesting that this church, I read this today, didn't know that, but this church was actually financed by the Romanov family, which were the Tsars of Russia. And assassination occurred in St. Petersburg. We were here in 2004, and this picture doesn't do justice to it. It's not one of my pictures. I'm going to bring one of mine. They're better. But it is absolutely gorgeous. I have never been in any place where I would say, when talk about human beauty, something that man has done is more beautiful. I mean, it's probably not our taste. You know, it's sort of Asian and to us maybe a little busy, but the little tiles are no more than eighth or a quarter inch square. I mean, it's absolutely incredible, and you basically don't see any mortar joint. It's just done so beautifully. So you think they're paintings, but they're actually, you said, those are paintings. You look up close, they're mosaics. And the whole church inside, as you see, is full of mosaics. So I mentioned that. I could sit here and talk quite a bit about this church because it is beautiful. It was built after the assassination on the spot, as I said, of the assassination of Alexander II. And then it was closed under Russian communism in 1930, and then it was redone in 1997. So when we were there in 2004, it was brand new, and it looked exactly like it. That's an aside. I just thought I had to tell you about that. And in case you ever go to St. Petersburg, maybe somebody's been there. No? Okay. It is one of the great places to go if you go to Russia. Who wants to go to Russia today? Oh, you'd be safe if you did. Okay, now we have leaders. The Dreyfus trial in Paris stirred the conscience of Theodor Herzl, 1894. Herzl determined that he was going to make a lifelong effort to establish a homeland for the Jews. Stirred by the injustice of this Dreyfus trial, remember this was a general accused of espionage and selling secrets to Germany, and it was a trumped-up charge. But anyway, he covered that, as you remember, and became convinced that Dreyfus was not guilty, and eventually was exonerated, but that didn't change the thing. He had now dug his heels in, and he wanted to spend his lifetime developing a homeland for Israel, and so we called him the father of Zionism. So the conference attended in 1897 about 200 people plus the observers, and he solidified the idea that never died out until the nation was established about 50 years later, actually 51 years later. So Zionism was born. Theodor Herzl was the father, and he is so honored in Israel that they honored his request to have his bones and his family bones moved back from, he was buried in Budapest, back to Israel, and there he is buried outside of Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum. Some of you have been there. I think next time I might go to Herzl's tomb. There, by the way, the film I talked about last week, it is a dream or something like that, is Twilight is getting it, so if you want to stand in line to look at it, please do. It's worth doing. Now, this is not my statement. I thought it was great, so I was going to read this now and I was going to read it at the end, but I don't think I'll have time to do it at the end, so I'm going to do it now. I say these events of World War I are so significant. How significant? In 1900, at the dawn of the new century, in the 2700th year of the existence of the Ottoman Empire, began to die a violent climatic death. We're going to talk about the Ottoman Empire tonight. The forces that destroyed this old and once powerful state capitulated the Middle East, Europe, and indeed the world toward increased instability and chaos. Out of the ruins of the Ottoman Empire rose the forces that combined directly or indirectly to some of the most long-lasting and horrific conflicts to afflict the world since 1914. Both world wars, the Holocaust, the rise and reign of Soviet communism in Russia, the Arab-Israeli wars, the various Iraq wars, and the terrorism that shook the world on September 11, 2001, are all related. All these events and the worldwide violence that ensued originated to some degree with the death throes of the Ottoman Empire. That's why I think we need to look at it, and we talked about that a little bit last week. We got to the point where Theodor Herzl went as far as he could go, and the next obstacle was the Ottoman Empire, because they were the custodians of the land. There was no way that the Jews could go back to any land, much less Israel, as long as the Ottoman Empire was in place. That's where I left it. So we have the setting of the stage. The Lord may be slow. I love this. The Lord may be slow, but he is never late. The process of restoring Israel to the land is done methodically by the Lord And that's why we're studying history, because he is doing it. As we study this process, we become impatient, don't we, while the bridegroom is delayed. He is not late and will make his appearance first for the church and then to deal with the chosen family in the most horrific persecution they have ever seen, even though they say it will never happen again. It will happen again. Then with new hearts, Israel will be saved and enjoy the promises that were given to Abraham some 4,000 years ago. That's what we're looking for, and that's what we're expecting to happen. Now, we're going to sidestep a little bit to Russia before we get into World War I. I wanted to finish this up about the pogroms. Now, you notice Russia is a huge country. I think there's 12 or 13 time zones, and we have four in our country. And you see it's divided into three divisions, the Siberian, and then the European Russia, and the Ural Mountains divide that up and down. And then you have the Russia, Central Asia. And today, Russia is not quite covering all of that, but it has in history, and Putin is somewhat right when he says, when he's going back to the Crimea and wants to claim it and claim all of the Ukraine, that that used to be Russia, and he's right. Because there was a personage back in history that I'm familiar with named Catherine the Great, and she was a female Putin. And I could get on the track there. But she conquered, or had conquered for her, these territories, and they were Muslim territories. They were the son of Catherine the Great. She kicked out the Muslims from South Russia called the Ukraine, which was part of the Turkish Empire. You see, pieces of the Turkish Empire were starting to be just an example of being knocked down. So I just mentioned that because I looked at Catherine the Great, and my background's Mennonite and Brethren background, so we look back to the Mennonites, and we see Catherine the Great was the one that provided the space in South Russia. Well, in order to do that, they had to kick out the Muslims to do that. And so then all these pacifistic Mennonites came over there to live in the wake of somebody else's violence. I think it's kind of interesting. I have that particular point of view. All right, so that's Russia. We're going to sidestep a little bit to Russia, not for Russia's sake, but something. I want to ask you this question, and I don't want you to answer it for me because I want you to answer to yourself a little bit. When the pogroms in Russia attacked the Jews so violently, do you have any idea, and I want you to raise your hand if you do, you have any idea how the Jews got to Russia? How the Jews got to Russia? Don't be embarrassed. They walked. Okay, I like that. I like that. No one knows. I just want to know how, the word's not ignorant, it's not the right word here. I said, you don't know how the Jews got to Russia. I'm glad about that because that's what I'm going to tell you. Now, if you leave the class, you still don't know. Get somebody else to teach your class. All right. Okay, we'll deal with history in this lesson. I've said that already. There is no secular history. It is all sacred. Therefore, the church should know. This is my little speech. Therefore, the church should know about world history, especially as it relates to the work of God in the church and Israel. Remembering, history is a record of what God has done in the world. I would say that's part of his glory. We may or may not have interest in this, however, if we are to understand and appreciate God's fingerprints, it is in the evidence, in the events of the earth, we need to know as much of it as possible. It is never too late to start. I'll give you my little story. I started about 1990 when I was old already. So we deal with events around World War I and how 700-year Ottoman Empire collapsed, opening the way for the Jewish nation to be enriched, established. If we pay no attention to this history, we will not see the glory of God in this event, working complete the prophecies that are 4,000 years old. Since the pogrom started in 1881 in Russia, it constitutes, I think, the linchpin or the trigger event that set in motion Zionism and the eventual establishment of the Jewish state of Israel, perhaps. We ought to look a little deeper into the question. Obviously, no one raised a hand about if they knew how the Jews got to Russia. So we got to talk about this. So how did the Jews get to Russia, seeing their hatred for the Jews? How in the world could the Russians all of a sudden find these Jews in their midst when they hate them so much? Who let the door open? Well, remember, our study of Russia in 1881 is not at the beginning of the work of God. Like, life didn't begin when we were born. There was life before our birth. So God was working in things before 1881. Okay, our study in Russia is not the beginning of the work of God and the people of Israel to restore the nation. It was going on before that. As we'll see that each historical element works without the direct plan or intervention of man. I mean, man doesn't set out and figure this out. Even Herzl didn't figure it out. But in 1881, everything was in place for the beginning of the unstoppable avalanche of restoration events. So we'll ask again, how did the Jews get to Russia? I'll tell you. Religious tolerance in the 16th and the first half of the 17th century, Jewish population grew considerably, up to 500,000 Jews in Poland. Remember where Adolf Hitler went to get his Jews to haul them off to the gas chambers? Poland. Now we got to know. See, now we know need to know a little bit of our history to get this figured out. That's why I'm here. There are 500,000 Jews in Poland. About 5%. I even saw someplace up to 10%. Maybe in certain areas, up to 10% of the population were Jewish in Poland, or at least parts of it. New arrivals were due to Sephardic Jews. Sephardic Jews are the ones from Spain. Remember the Spanish Inquisition. The Spain ran out the Jews in 1492. All right, so where'd they go? Partly to Poland. See that map? I don't know if you can see that very well or not. But all those lines show dates and places where they came from and where they went to. And they all go around that. I don't have a pointer yet. Yeah, does that work? All right, they all end up over here. Guess what's here? Poland. Poland is here. Depending on what era you're talking about. Raleigh's going, I'm not going to tell you. All right, so they're coming from Germany, Austria, Hungary, and they're going up this way. They're coming out of the Crimea. They're coming this way, go to Lithuania, and end up here. The history of the Jews in Poland dates back over 800 years. For centuries, Poland was home to the largest and most significant Jewish country in the world. And I circle it there in the middle of the map. And again, we have numbers there, and they have by far the most numbers. I can't read on my screen. There it says 3 million Polish Jews. 3 million. Remember, Israel now has 7. So almost half of what's in Israel in one country. Poland was the center of Jewish culture thanks to a long period of statutory religious tolerance and social autonomy. The first extent of Jewish emigration from Western Europe to Poland occurred at the time of the First Crusade. So we go back even almost 1,000 years. Almost 1,000 years. Okay. And so Poland became more tolerant as the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, the acquisition 350 years ago, as well as from Austria, Hungary, and Germany. Now, remember, Germany doesn't exist until 1871. There's no Germany. We keep talking about Germany. Why do we talk about Germany? Any idea? German-speaking people. That's why we talk about Germans. My background was German, had German. Well, somewhere along we pick up German and we gave that up, and now we talk English, kind of. So German was sort of the language, Saxony, Germany. And it was made up like 100 city-states, unorganized. I'm talking up till 1871. So when I talk about Germany up till 1871, we're talking about the area, but not organized. So Poland became tolerant just as the Jews were expelled from Spain. And then I talked about Germany, thus stimulating Jewish immigration to the much more accessible Poland. There's another place where there was religious tolerance during the Reformation. That was Northern Holland. Northern Holland, where the persecution of the Catholic Church wasn't severe. Southern Holland was called Spanish Netherlands. Their persecution of the Catholics was strong. So like my background, the Mennonites, they came from Northern Holland, where a lot of people that were the Huguenots that were from France, Southern France, they went to Northern Holland. All the tradespeople, all the good people, the useful people that could build something and do something went to these free places, and Northern Holland was one of them. And Poland was such a place for the Jews. Indeed, with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, Poland became the recognized haven for exiles from Western Europe, resulting in ascension to the ranks of Polish Jewry. Many made it the culture and spiritual center for the Jewish population. Again, you just see that big yellow blob. And we have these nations that are around them. We have Russia and Poland and Germany, not yet organized, but it's going to be there soon. And then Central Europe, which is just in a state of flux. But in Poland, we have the Jews. We're not terribly interested in the rest right now. See how, I cannot point. See how Germany, where Germany is, it's a bunch of little, you know, molded states. It's not solidified yet. So we have these three countries that are around there. We have Russia, Austria, and Germany. And maybe we can use the word Prussia. That was the name that was used. My grandmother, we always said we came from Poland, our ancestors came. No, it's not Poland, it's Prussia. We'd say Poland. No, it's Prussia. So I got that in my head, from Prussia. So they would, okay, now we'll talk about why this is so different, because there are three partitioning events in Poland. And I'll just tell you real quickly, because I want to have time to do it slowly. Three partitioning events, they're given on your screen there, 1772, 1793, 1795. After these three partitioning events by these three countries or entities around Poland, Poland doesn't exist. Totally wiped out. Doesn't exist as a nation. But we do have Prussia, and we have all these other little lineages, and Russia, so forth. So I'm going to give you a little bit. I was going to go through this, but it's too tedious. There's the first partition, second partition, and the third partition. I'm going to leave it up here, so online that stuff can be read. But we don't have time now. Now, the three partitions, I know, I imagined a line, or try to approximate the better word, a line between Russia and what will be Germany and so forth, and that's what you see there. Now, okay, you got that line? See, everything to the right is Russia, to the left you don't care about, okay? Now, look where the Jews end up being. The red is the Jews. And that line, I kind of guesstimate that's about where that line is. And that's how the Jews got to Russia. They woke up one morning and says, George, I think we're in a new country. Did you dream last night? No. The powers that be moved the borders. Now all of a sudden you were in Russia. Did Russia want all these Jews? I guess not. They started these pogroms against them. And you see the dark red here is where the most of them were. So there's a few over here. I may have missed my line here a little bit here. This is the Black Sea. Here's the Crimea. And the Dnieper River goes up along here. And so this is, as good as I can do for you. This is a picture of these in subdivisions. It's what's called the Pale. And I mentioned that to you. We've used this expression, they're beyond the Pale. Well, the Pale is the Jewish settlement. So if you lived in the Pale, you were living inside the Jewish settlement. If you're beyond the Pale, you were not outside the Jewish settlement. And if you're a Jew living outside the Pale, you're in trouble. They get you by your ears and drag you back at best. So here's, the Black Sea down here, it's a Crimea, and so forth. I'll maybe read a little bit about this Exodus here. I can. Now the principal town, remember, under the programs we had, in 1882, 500,000 Jews living in rural areas in the Pale were forced to leave their homes and live in towns and townlets in the Pale, 250,000 living along the western frontier of Russia were also moved into the Pale. So, it almost became a ghetto situation. I was thinking, it told me the number of people that left here. Okay, the Pale settlement in Russia, Jews confined to the area by law, 1795. By 1885, there were over 4 million Jews living in the Pale. I didn't say anything about the exiting here. But when they exited here, they left from this town here and they went west. All right, so now we know what the Pale is. We know how the Jews got into Russia. They got in there by the partitioning of Poland. Poland was very weak. They could no longer maintain their borders. Guess what? Some other country takes them over. And the Jews didn't leave. I mean, after all, that's their home. And they were accepted in Polish and Prussian, all these other territories. But when the Russian came in, they were persona non grata. So Russia acquires Polish territory. The term pogrom, in the meaning of large-scale, targeted, repeated anti-Jewish rioting, saw its first use in the 19th century in reference to the anti-Jewish pogroms in the Russian Empire. That's where it started, because it's a Russian word. The pogroms began occurring after the Russian Empire, which previously had very few Jews, we saw that, and they acquired Jewish territories with large Jewish populations. Three waves of partitioning of weak Poland, which disappears to for more than 100 years, Poland disappears, comes back after World War I. These territories were designated the Pale of Settlement by the Russian government, which within which the Jews were reluctantly permitted to live, and was within them that the pogroms largely took place. Most Jews were forbidden from moving to other parts of the empire unless they converted to Orthodox Christianity, in that case be Russian Orthodox, which is what those churches were, I showed you. So I showed you again in that middle, the pink or the blue is where the area of the Jews resided. And you see they're mostly in Russia. The territorial divisions were altered in 1807 when Emperor Napoleon of France created the Duchy of Warsaw out of the central province of Russia, Prussian Poland, and in 1815. When the Congress of Vienna created the Congress of Kingdoms of Poland, however, the main result of the partitions and so forth, the elimination of the sovereign state of Poland, which was in fact till after World War I, when the Polish Republic was established. All right, so some of you might be Polish and you came from Poland. At least you know, if you didn't know that history, now you do. The obstacle of the Turks or the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman means Osman. It's a dynasty. And one of the reasons that the Ottoman Empire was so poor because it was an empire of a dynasty of how can I be kind? Children that were incapable of running anything. And since they're the children, you know, they stay in power. Okay, we are up to World War I last week. The pogroms again against the Jews continued in Russia in the 20th century. The Ottoman Empire continues to bleed out acres and acres of land to their neighboring countries. We saw that, and I saw that with South Russia with Catherine the Great. For centuries, we saw how this impacted the Jewish Pale, moving it into Russia. So here we have our Ottoman Empire pretty much at the time of World War I, 1914. Of the course of the decline from, say, 1600, besides ineptness. Now here's what I was trying to say kindly. Ineptness, nepotism, etc. The decline was inevitable with the ideals of Islam, that renders any peoples lethargic and useless to national development and defense. If Allah wills it, I'll get up. If not, I'll see you at night for dinner. The empire started in 1453 when Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire, fell. The last vestiges of the Roman Empire, Constantinople, now Istanbul, when Sultan Muhammad II, and the conquest of Constantinople. After him, we have Suleiman the Magnificent. I think I called him Suleiman the Great last week, which is a mistake. Suleiman the Magnificent. Now, the zenith of this Ottoman Empire reached by Suleiman the Magnificent was the one who built the Jerusalem walls, and he started to build them in 1537. So when you go to Israel, you go to Jerusalem, you see those walls standing are built during this time, just right after the Reformation. And by and large, they're still as they were, built in the wrong place. For which the guy that put him in the wrong place gave up his life. All right, so enough of that. Just to give you some connection with this personage that you know at least something that he's done that you can identify with. Now, coming up to World War, we have this question about the Middle East here, and here we need to spend more time than we have, but it is pretty obvious to think. I was going to bring you that old ancient map. Maybe you've seen it. It has three leaves on it, you know, like leaves, has one like this. And one down in the middle of it's Jerusalem. It's called the world map, of ancient world map. The ancient people saw Jerusalem in the middle of the world, just as God saw it in the middle of the world. I could have brought you that. Well, in some sense, that whole Levant area, the Levant, is that eastern Mediterranean Sea shoreline. That's called the Levant. Sometimes it's called Syria. Sometimes it's called Phoenicia. We call it Israel, at least the bottom part of it. Well, that area is very important. And we've heard this before, that God is wise, understatement, to pick a spot for Israel to have land where everybody's going to walk through it. Because that way you don't have to have any missionary force, because they all come to you. You don't have to go out to them. So we have a spot in the eastern Mediterranean that is somewhat of a bottleneck. And if you can control that, you can control the world. It's kind of like in Israel. We talk about if you can control Megiddo and Hazor, those two places, you can control the world. Because in the Levant, you got to go through the swamps. And to stay off the swamps, you got to stay on the path. And the path goes through these forts. So if you can't get to, if you can't get past the fort and you can't get in the swamp without getting bogged down, you'll control the world. So you really get down to something so simple. You can control the world by controlling two forts, and they're in Israel. Megiddo, we know about that, and that'll be the last place where the battles are fought. All right, so I'm building up for you in your mind the importance of this spot. England recognizes the importance of this spot. So British, they want to gain access to the east. Now, what's to the east? Business. What do they have that we want? Spices, whatever. You know, all these things that we buy at the grocery store, they got to go, you know, 4,000 miles away to get. But they're so good and so important, they become trade. So British wants to have access to the east, and they don't really want to go around the Horn of Africa, because at that time they didn't even know you could do that. So they were really stuck to go over land with camels and no train tracks. So if they get a waterway down the Persian Gulf and out, boy, it saves them a lot of time. And around in this, 17th, 19th century, they build the Suez Canal. So now all of a sudden that becomes a waterway that's, you know, you can go from England, you can sail clear through Gibraltar and through the Mediterranean, you got near the Indian Ocean, and you're gone, you know. So England wants to control this area. Well, guess what? Russia wants to control it too, because they're not so much interested maybe in Levant, although it's connected to it. What they want is a warm water port, which is the Black Sea. You know, if you look at the map, all their ports are to the north, and they usually get frozen in. So you get a warm water port to the south. And I look at this with such amazing thoughts about the amazing way that God allowed the world to be formed after the flood. If you have these waters are so precious, the Mediterranean is so precious and so important, but you know there's two spots you can shut them down. One is Gibraltar, and the other one is the Dardanelles, which is the Bosphorus, which dumps the water from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean Sea. You control those two ports, and no one can go in or go out. So it's kind of like, wow. So you got to be friendly with these people, or else you are not going to go anywhere. So Russia wants to have a control of this. Guess who's right below Russia? Turkey. Who owns Turkey? It's the Ottoman Empire. And we have France. All I got to talk about France. Well, they don't, you know, what they want is what England wants. That's all they got to decide. We don't really need it. If England wants it, we want it. So they're in the mix somewhat too, but not quite so much. In fact, it's interesting how much France has helped Israel over the years. The first jets that Israel flew in 1967 war were French-made, what they call them, Mirage jets. So France has been sort of, you know, kind of helping without knowing, I guess. So we got the British, we got the Russians, and we got the French, sort of less important. And then we have Germany that doesn't exist till 1871, but they do become a factor in World War I, because then they've been around already for a while. So all of saying this area is important. And right now, the Ottoman Empire controls it. A little bit about Germany here. In fact, I read a book on Germany one time. I said, I got to figure out how this thing happened because I just don't understand it. So I read a book, and I understand a little bit more about it. Like I explained to you that they were these city-states, and they got consolidated by Otto von Bismarck and unified the German-speaking people, and it was called the Reich. The first Reich was Charlemagne, 800 A.D. And who was the third? Hitler. All right. He was taking lessons from his predecessors. So he was going to have a 1,000-year Reich. All right, so we have Germany now, a new kid on the block, really, even in the division of Poland. Germany dominates Europe, makes France terribly scared, because here's Germany, and here's France, and here's Russia, and here's Germany. See, they're in a position to control everything. So it dominates Europe for 30 years, from 1871 on, gets you about to 1900. The presence of the new powerful nation upsets the European nation balance of power. You know, all France, they had territories somewhere else. British had territories all over the world. Russian had territories. Germany had nothing. And so they're saying, you know, we've got all this stuff. Germany's got nothing. You know what? It's not going to be long. He's going to come after our stuff. So they worry about it. So World War I can be partly traceable to the intrusion of Germany on the European scene. Wilhelm II, which is the third Kaiser after von Marby II, will be the Kaiser starting World War I. And we see his picture at the bottom a little bit. So now Germany, you see how big it is, the blue, the green, huge. You know, maybe you don't see the scale, but it's a big place. World War I. In the years leading up to 1914, the beginning of World War I, the main European nations were on their were for their own reasons of supremacy, dividing up the corpse of the Ottoman Empire before it was dead. They had these meetings, talk about, you take that, you take that, you take this. France and England had meetings, secret meetings, the Sykes-Picot meeting before it was over, was who's going to get what. The British wanted access to the East, I told you that. Surely did not want a competitor nation to have it like Russia or Germany or France. And now we're talking in the days of Churchill. And we have Germany as a newly unified nation finding its place where there had been Poland and the Austro-Hungarian empires. Two wanted its place in history, having no international territories. The other monarchs wondered what Germany would do to expand her as other nations had done. It is possible that Chancellor, this is really interesting. This is probably conjecture, but, you know, Mr. Chancellor Wilhelm II made trips to Turkey. It is possible that German Chancellor Wilhelm II was so enamored with Islam, he went to watch the dancing girls at the harem at the Topkapi Palace, that he may have been a secret convert to Islam. Thus, a favorable courtship of Turkey conflicted with the request of Theodor Herzl to allow settlement in the land. After a visit to the land, Wilhelm was, and that's what you see here. I got a picture of Lund's horse over here. And then we have Herzl. There's a picture of them together, but it was a doctored picture, so they didn't really have one. And here's the Shah, here's the, not the Shah, what do you call him? The Sultan, thank you. Sitting there that he'd have to deal with. So after a visit to the land, the two of them, Wilhelm and Herzl, Wilhelm rejected Herzl's request to influence the Sultan of the Ottomans, and that whole deal fell through. And then it says, well, we said, with a no here, then God puts the next phase of his plan to work, which is going to be, okay, if you don't give it up voluntarily, we'll take it from you by force. That's called World War I. Because when they're done, the Ottoman Empire will not exist. There will be a Turkey, but no Ottoman Empire. That dynasty is gone. It's nothing. Now, being a student of European history cannot be a part-time job. I thought that was kind of cute. So there's so much. I say, if there are people that have studied in history, they're probably going to run circles around what I say here. But it's difficult because there are so many pieces to it. But I am reminded of Daniel chapter 2, verse 41. It says, in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, and it was divided, and it was a divided kingdom. We're talking about Europe. It will have in it the toughness of iron as much as you saw the iron mixes with common clay, as the toes of the feet were part of iron, part of clay or pottery. So some of the kingdoms will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, that you they will continue with one another in the seed, in the seeds of men, but they will not adhere to one another as iron does, not combined with pottery. So we see this picture of Europe never really getting it pulled off. And the euro that we have, that they have now, is not doing the job either. In fact, you know, with Greece not paying their debts, it's about to fall apart. Now, border disputes. We have seen that borders between Russia, Prussia, Austria changed three times in the late 18th century. Other disputes between Germany and France, Alsace, Lorraine, Strasbourg, which is German in France today, German-speaking people in France, beautiful city. Greece, Macedonia, Turkey, Russia, Ukraine, Austria, Germany, Croatia, Serbia, and the list goes on with border disputes. They have a long history. Therefore, in the early 20th century, there were plenty of grievances to go around, and each country had their reason to go to war to reclaim honor, dignity, and, of course, the land that they thought was in dispute. So the Austrian-Hungarian Empire ruled over Serbia. Look over there. See the green line? Maybe I should do this. The green line circles Austria and Serbia. They're in one country. Then we have Bosnia to the left. We have Poland, which has been divided into three. Germany to the top. And Turkey down below, Levant to the right. All right, so that's basically pretty easy to figure out, I hope. Okay. Now, Austria-Hungary Empire ruled over Serbia in 1914. There was great autonomy granted to Serbia, bottom part, yet it was an irritation to some in Serbia, especially the right-wingers. You know who they are, the conservative ones. They feared that Austria would move the border and take more of Serbia. And apparently there had been some border disputes over the centuries, whatever, and I didn't go search that out because you wouldn't want to know about it anyway. So apparently there's some minor or major dispute going on with the border. But it wasn't serious. It wasn't like yesterday. So this border dispute was in the mental image and from the political right more than an existential threat. The commonly held notion that World War I was started out of an outrage over the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife Sophie, at the hands of a Serbian nationalist secret society known as the Black Hand, isn't entirely correct, although it happened. There was an assassination, but there's much more to this. In fact, the Emperor Franz Joseph himself expressed relief over the Austrian Empire, over the assassination, because it rid him of an heir whom he deeply disliked. So it's kind of, whew, got rid of him, so I'm not going to complain. It's an assassination. It's okay, I know, it's just tough, but leave it alone. So the emperor commented that God will not be mocked. A higher power had put back the order I couldn't maintain. Now, he couldn't do it, so God did it for him. Now, indeed, it wasn't just the emperor who was relieved. It was reported by an Austrian newspaper that the general consensus among the various political circles that the assassination, though a tragedy, was for the best. As far as the Austrian people were concerned, it was noted that even that event almost failed to make any impression whatsoever. On Sunday and on Monday, the crowds in Vienna listened to music and drank wine as if nothing had happened. Indeed, it took the government itself a full 3 weeks to react. So it really wasn't a big deal. In fact, it was kind of a welcome thing. Well, what kind of trouble are we in now? Well, let's start out with the alliances. I tried to show them to you in the spaghetti there. Okay, I didn't really try to do that. But I gave you 11 alliances that go back some hundreds of years, go back. So these alliances tie us all together. You know, it's almost like a spaghetti, you know. Oh, yeah, that's right. I got to deal with you, too. Oh, but I forgot about that one. Well, how about you? Oh, well. You know, so you get all these things, and I don't know how they kept it straight. So we have these alliances that Europe is held together by. Hard to call it shoestrings. As you will shortly see, the treaty alliance system that was prevalent in Europe with numerous treaties and interconnecting and various with the various states was really at the heart of what would have been a small conflict, not noteworthy in any way in history, escalated into one of the bloodiest wars in human history with over 15 million people dead. I've seen all kinds of numbers. Just think of a big one. It's probably not big enough. Somewhat ironically, the spark that set it all off was the assassination that no one really cared about. So why go to war over an assassination if no one cared? Well, because no one seemed to care that much about the assassination itself. Austria-Hungary had been looking for an excuse to wage a preventative war against the Serbs. Okay, Austria against the Serbs. Yes, now, I don't understand these relationships all the time. It's like, well, they are separate, but they're not separate. So apparently there's a distinction here that was going to be pushed. I got them together because they really were under their control. And so when they're under control, Austria can make demands on the subject, which is what was happening. Okay, I think I'm going to read this to you. Okay, Austria and Hungary had been looking for an excuse to wage a preventative war against the Serbs as a state in order to weaken or destroy them so as to take back territory from the Balkans. So even though they're in their hegemony, there still isn't like it's really our nation yet. It's kind of like it's an annex. I don't know how to explain it. Okay, they had not taken it back up to this point because they lacked German support. Germany is up to the north. They're allies. See the smiley face? Germany, okay, they're allies. But Germany wasn't going to, no, I don't like getting involved in that kind of war. You guys are still, you know, and then Austria said, oh, we can't do it by ourselves. And this is in my notes, but what happened here, I'm going to run out of time. What happened here, the Wilhelm tells them, say, well, it's a small dispute. Do whatever you want to do. I don't care what you do. I'm going to go on vacation. He gets on his boat and leaves. Now, he's the guy that's going to, you know, guarantee this war or not. So he gets on the boat, tells Serbs to go ahead and do it, or Austrian Empire to go ahead and do it, to invade Serbia, which they do. And he comes back. I don't know when they do it exactly. He comes back and he says, well, it's not such a good idea. Well, why would you tell us before you left? So anyway, it's that kind of thing going on. Just let a bunch of monkeys run around with their heads chopped off. Let's see what I missed here. Austria and Hungary had been looking for an excuse to wage war against Serbia as a state order to weaken and destroy. Okay. They had not taken it back to this point because they lacked German support. I read that to you. All right. So they're just kind of weak, but they want it back. Now, the Austrian ultimatum. Now, with the assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand and his wife June 1914, Austria and Hungary was able to secure the promise of the German, that's what I just said, that it would aid in the war with Serbia and possibly Russia. Now, Russia is going to be on the side of Serbia. So when you get involved with Germany or Austria, then right away Russia and Serbia go together. So you got to, you know, count them. You know, how's the song go? No one to hold them and no one to fold them. So they're counting the cards. It should be noted that the Austro-Hungary did not expect Russia to enter the fray, as they expected this to be a very short war and it would be over quickly. In fact, even before Wilhelm got back on his boat, the thing would be over. They have the border would be settled, except it didn't work out that way. Now, with Germany's support, if Russia did enter the fray, Austria and Hungary issued an ultimatum to the Serbs, and remarkably, you know, to avoid war, so we want you to do these, I think it were 10 things, and these are severe things. Then if you do these things, we won't go to war. So these limited Serbia, and let's see, I'm going too fast. I got to read this or I'll miss something. Austria and Hungary issued an ultimatum to Serbia with remarkable severe terms that Serbia would be sure to reject, so they'd go to war, thus giving Austria-Hungary an excuse to go to war. Okay, to launch the limited war. All right. But they accepted it, except for a couple of minor things. Surprisingly, Serbia responded relatively well to the ultimatum, but they did not pursue a few minor clauses, and which gave Austria-Hungary the excuse they needed to go to war. At this point, the following general series of events happened due to the variety of existing treaties, various of nations, which escalated this minor clash into the First World War. So in the end, a small, quick war over a minor land dispute got turned into a lengthy war that joined by powers all over the globe due to a variety of existing treaties dating back as much as 75 years before the war started. Now, a reminder. If what God does in the world always is a statement about what God will do in Israel, maybe that's an overstatement, but it's getting close to the full truth, then we must be alert to the idea that if the Ottoman Empire stands in the way of the national state of Israel, it will be removed. If the Sultan stood in the way of Theodore Herzl in 1898, as it is it an overreach to see God at work to remove the Islamic grip on the land, even by force, by the neighboring nations. He did that with Assyria, did it with Babylon, and he's done that before. In the end, the Islamic Ottoman Empire will be historically dead. It will cost Turkey 1 out of 4 citizens, 25% of their population. Now, just look at Israel's losses. This is a lot later, 1948, the War of Independence. There were about 800,000 people in Israel, and out of that group, 895 died, which is 0.0001 or 0.011%. Remember, Austrians lose 1 out of 4. All right, so we have these passages in Acts, talks about the nations go their own way, and God permits them to do that. And then he also said that God appoints their boundaries and their habitations, and that's all true, and we see that here. World War I was Act One, and World War II was Act Two of the two world wars. They present the outcome of ideas of man. In the process of restoring the Jews to the land, there has been unimaginable bloodshed over the question of the land. The conflict still has not claimed its last victim. What better outcome for all the Turks had they taken the offer of Herzl and allowed the Jews into the land, even if they got nothing for it? Instead, the Turks died at the rate of 1 in 4, 5 million deaths. Okay, now here's your world war. The Axis powers, they're here, the Allied powers. In the process, we have four major, and in some sense, wonderful functioning monarchies destroyed. They're the monarchy of Germany, the monarchy of Ottoman, the monarchy of the Austria-Hungary, and Russia is destroyed. The Romanovs get dethroned. Romanovs. Strong leadership has all but disappeared from our world since then. Now, there were a few in World War II. The war that consumed itself was fought for no good reason except to change the world order forever. Every off-ramp to avoid the war was missed, or the time of the telegram was off, or for the lack of a telephone, or for an untimely vacation by Wilhelm II, and the untimely heart attack. I was going to look that one up. They were sitting at the conference table. They had made the agreement, and the guy falls over dead. I mean, it's incredible. And then we don't want to forget the simple human belligerence factors in here. Now, I want to give you this one example. The Archduke France, Ferdinand of Austria, and his wife Sophie. You see pictures of them here. And they're coming out moments before they're assassinated to get in their open car. To give an example, what might have happened if. The Archduke of Austria and Hungary and his wife were on vacation in their own country's holdings, where I show the little asterisk, in Bosnia. Remember, they're Austrian, but they're in Bosnia. That's part of their hegemony, yet it's considered separate. But they're not in Serbia. Remember, the border dispute was between Serbia and Austria. So they're not even in the country. They're not in Serbia. They're in Bosnia. The Archduke of Sofia and his wife, they were in Bosnia, ruled by the family in a safe place. Now, a group of these guys were young thugs, the Black Hand or Dark Hand or something like that they're called, group of teenage thugs acting as Serbian, over here, Serbian patriots seized the opportunity to attempt an assassination. Four of them lined the tour route, spaced out, with the idea that someone of the group would have the opportunity to pull off the assassination by a bomb or by a gun. However, as the open car passed one by one, the first two, they became fearful and even felt sorry for the wife, couldn't kill her. Two of them did not act. Well, however, as the third assassin was approached, he threw a bomb at the Archduke. He ducked, or somehow the bomb at least didn't hit them. It was overthrown and landed underneath a car, blew that car up, and 16, 20 people around, don't think anybody got killed, but the royal couple escaped unharmed, moved quickly on. Guess why? The remaining assassin, that's three. The remaining assassin could not attempt a bomb as he flew by the fast-moving car. He entered the tavern and licked his mental wounds. Now, number three, bomb thrower, had taken an expired cyanide pill. Poor guy, nothing worked out for this guy. Jumped off the bridge, threw up a bunch, got hurt, landing in 4 inches of water instead of a stream, got hurt, anyway, got easily captured. But so we still have one left yet. However, the magnanimous royal couple decide to visit the injured folk in the hospital. The chauffeur, unfamiliar with the city, makes a wrong turn, misses the turn, and forced to make a U-turn. As the last assassin sees the open car coming, he springs up, runs and jumps on the running board of the car, opening fire, shooting two shots. Both the Archduke and his wife were hit in the neck and her in the stomach. Both were dead in an hour. Well, one of the ironies of this whole thing is that Archduke would probably be a great advocate for Serbian ideals, and he'd kill him. That's an aside. Now, of course, the question is, what will the Serbians do now? This starts the next saga of the series of blunders, missteps, and errors, where in the end millions die and a generation of men wiped out for something that never was really threatened, the border between Serbia and Austria. Will you stick with me to let me finish this? I have one more story to tell. You like stories, don't you? Okay. All right, this is the last story, and then my summary. Do be done in a half hour. No, I just... Tsar Nicholas, number two. He's the one that's reigning during the World War I. Weak man. As the outbreak of the war was imminent, July 24, in that section when Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany had returned from his... Maybe I haven't finished my story yet. Yeah, I did. Had returned from his poorly timed vacation, advised allied Austro-Hungary not to pursue the war, which they'd already started. Serbian had given in to all the demands. Don't start a war. They've given in to all the demands. But they started the war. So Germany was on the side of Austria-Hungary, whereas Russia was on the side of the Serbians. Wilhelm said to the Austrian-Hungarians, don't do it. Don't start the war. What they kind of already had started. Don't escalate. Play it down. So the Austrian-Hungarians wanted a war. They wanted a war. Since it takes 3 weeks to get a war going from Russia to help them, Serbia had declared war on Nona. I said that. They threw a bomb at something. I don't know how far they got, in spite of the inability of Russians to join them. They sort of stuck the neck out and started the war without Russia being committed. So we have this tension between Germany and Russia. In an attempt to stop the escalation of this war, this little fire that could easily be put out, the Germans send their ambassador with words of warning to Tsar Nicholas II to stay out of the war. Let's don't make this any bigger than it is. The ambassador from Germany is still waiting for an answer. And Nicholas was pensive, not known for decisive acts. Remember Rasputin and his wife and the hemophilic child? Remember that old story? Ooh. The Tsar waits, looks out the window. Time passes. An unknown aide moving to his side, probably making some attempt at empathy, said to the Tsar that these decisions must be hard to make. Well, at that, apparently all the criticism of his past indecisiveness were going to be answered this time. And he spins around with his answer. And he said, no, we are going to war. And he did that 3 times, and we are going to war. And then German turns to him, and he shows him this prepared sign and gives it to him, and it said, Germany declares war on Russia. Could have stopped it right there. And we're talking about World War I here. Could have stopped it right there. Could have stopped it before. You start looking at the places. Somewhere along the way, we had this negotiation with her on the table, and the guy falls over dead. Okay, the Tsar would have backed down. Germany would not have supported the Austrian-Hungarian War, and the Serbs would not have proceeded very far, and the short war would have been over, and that would have been it. But it was not to be. The world's first global conflict, the Great War, pitted the central powers of Germany, Austria, and Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire against the allied forces of Great Britain, the United States, France, Russia, Italy, and Japan. The introduction of modern technology to warfare resulted in unprecedented carnage and destruction, with more than 9 million soldiers killed by the end of the war in November 1918. Germany had automatic guns. Airplanes were starting to provide surveillance and bombing. War was a new thing. This kind of war was a new thing. The Allies fought the old way. Just send boys. Have you seen some of these movies from World War I? They just send them out of these trenches. They'd be mowed down by the Germans. Send another wave of kids. It's absolutely incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Anyway, that's what happened because the Tsar, for one time, wanted to be decisive. All right, however, the war ends in an armistice. An armistice is an agreement to cease conflict. It doesn't end a war. It does not end a war, nor are there any victors or are there any defeated armies. This is how World War I ends, in this tense armistice. Since the Allied forces, Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, the United States, had the upper hand, they convene the Conference of Versailles in Versailles, France, the international authority to divide the disposed monarchical lands, mostly the Ottoman Empire. Now, with Russia had withdrawn, if you know a little bit about this story, Russia withdrew from this war because they were in the midst of their own civil war. There are two civil wars. I'm going to see this. I think I'm going to hit the. I better read what I wrote because I'll say it again. Okay, the end of the monarchy of Russia occurred as two revolutions tears the Romanov monarchy, Russia, off the throne, and in a second revolution in 6 months brings Marxism to Russia as Red Communism, October 1917. So you see that all is related back to this war. So now here's the summary. Well, we will deal with the Versailles Conference next, I hope. I never promise you anything anymore. For now it is clear how the Jews got to Russia without moving. Anybody miss that point tonight? You know they got there because Poland was destroyed. And the Jews didn't have to move. We understand the change of fortune for the Jews when the weak Polish government could not sustain themselves against expansionistic ideas of their aggressive nations, neighbors. Russia, Prussia, Austria-Hungary. Their hatred for the Jews could not be contained in Russia in 1881. The pogroms began on the Jews. Herzl approached the Sultan of Ottomans, but was rebuffed in his request for space for the Jews in his empire. The obstacle was the Ottoman Islamic Empire. It had to go, so World War I happened. Not have happened. The result is that the political obstacle was removed at a great cost of humanity. And then the issues of Versailles, we'll talk about that, we'll visit about that, and the subsequent, even as important and maybe more important, the San Remo conference in Italy will be next, and that is the official reason why Israel has authority in the land. Most people don't know about that. So the Jewish people were not ready, even back in those days, and maybe not yet today. The Jewish people are not ready to return to the land, nor was the enlarged world ready for them to return. These and many other subjects will be considered in the future. And I thank you for bearing with me for 8 minutes. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the evening together. Lord, again, for a peek in this very, very important part of history, Lord, that we've heard about but probably don't know much about, but it was significant in the life of Israel as you were preparing the way for them to be restored to the land. Now, we are still in the process. We're still observing that process going on. It's not complete, and it will not be completed really until you come in the air for your children. And then the deliberations with Israel on earth to bring them to the point of submission and where they will receive his Messiah. Thank you, Lord, for these hopes, for the Jewish friends that we have. May they avoid all the desperation they will face if they come to the Messiah and believe in him at this point and become part of the church. Thank you, Lord, for these weeks we have together. Pray, Lord, for my preparation that it might do the things that needs to be done so that we're encouraged and instructed in the things of history that might help us understand the word even better, even as we see the history in it. Keep us safe as we go to our home, and for your blessing in our lives, we thank you. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.